I want to thank Dan Applebaum very much for coming in. And Benjamin is one of the many students whom God has sent me as we got to make a new document on performance. As a student, which is to say an extremely bright student who is highly challenging to teachers, especially since it's not clear how much you have to teach them. This is from my first year of teaching, and it is a great pleasure to have somebody who was once a student before I had a teacher, and who is, as you guys all get by now, I think that investigative journalism is sacred work if done properly. And so I am very glad and proud to have a student who is almost finalist. So I can't ask for better than that, and I have no doubt that this will be a highly stimulating and challenging presentation, and I encourage you all to challenge him as much as he did me.
Good morning. Very glad to be here. I've been trying to figure out when the last time I was in Sharon was, but it's been a lot of years. I grew up here a little bit, but it's been a long time. I have heard a little bit about what you guys have talked about in previous sessions. If I'm walking too much over familiar ground, please let me know and I can just move on. But what I wanted to do is to sort of start from a basic beginning and talk a little bit about the ground rules within which we operate when we do investigative journalism, particularly with respect to the issue of how we interact with the people that we write about and how we choose them, how we talk to them, how we portray them when we write about them. Journalism is a funny thing to talk about ethics in journalism. Journalism is not a religion. By a lot of definitions, not even a profession. It's a set of tools that get used for a lot of different things. One of those things is what we call investigative journalism, which is, broadly defined, some effort to write about something that you're going out to find rather than having it brought to you. In general, our purpose is corrective, which is to say that we want something to be better than it is right now. We want to inform people about a problem or an inconsistency or an injustice or an inequality. We're trying to make the world a better place, broadly speaking. But in the nature of doing that is two choices. The first is, what are we going to write about? And the second is, how are we going to go about finding information that is not being brought to us, volunteered to us? And the first choice of what we're going to write about is something that newsrooms spend a lot of time thinking about. I'm not going to talk as much about it today, although I'm happy to if it's of interest. Broadly speaking, it's defined by the public interest, and I mean that in two senses. One is, what does the public find interesting, much of which can be fairly problematic, and second is, what should the public know, what does the public need to know, which is where I try to spend more of my life. But setting that aside, once you've picked the topic, whatever that topic is, the question is, how do you go out and report on it? With particular respect to the issues of privacy and of negative information, which I know is sort of at the core of what you all are thinking about, that poses a number of challenges, and I want to start by talking about sort of the broadest one and move inward from there. The broadest issue that we deal with that constrains the work that we do is truth. We're beholden to the idea that we should be going out and trying to find the truth. But I want to say from the beginning that we're not beholden to only printing the truth. That would be an extremely restrictive standard, and it's not one that we actually try to meet. What we try to do is to find the truth within the context of being timely, within the context of being, relevant. And that is ethically, again, an interesting thing because it means that our search for truth is defined by our medium. So, for example, back when people had, weeks to write, they had rather more time to look for the truth. I have 24 hours. I write for a daily newspaper on something of pressing importance. That's how long I have to look for the truth. People who write on the Internet have 15 minutes, and they tend to find less truth before they write. So that imperative is the context in which we talk about ethics and journalism. It's not an absolute standard. It's a question of, within the context of trying to produce something, how much time do we have to get towards the truth? How close can we get to the truth? And really the defining standard that we deal with is libel law, which is the law that governs what happens when you don't tell the truth. And libel law in America is extremely forgiving of journalism. It's sort of the outer boundary within which we live. And what the libel law says in America is you don't need to tell the truth, but you need to be trying in good faith to tell the truth. That's basically the standard. It's not a very old standard in its defined form. It dates actually to the civil rights era in America. It dates to a very famous case called Sullivan versus New York Times, in which the New York Times printed an advertisement critical of the police and by extension the government in Alabama and their treatment of civil rights protesters. There were factual errors in the ad. It contained misstatements, referenced the wrong people in some instances, accused them of doing things they apparently had not done. It was not entirely true. And the county commissioner in the jurisdiction in question, a guy named Sullivan, sued the New York Times and said basically, you've lied about me. You've gone into my life and you've lied about me. And it went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court basically found that the only circumstances under which a newspaper cannot print a lie about a public official are if they essentially knew that it was false and printed it with malice, with an intent to do harm to that person. This is one end of the standard as far as truth goes. So in other words, we can be careless about public officials. We can print things that might be true. We can print rumors. We can print allegations, characterizations, you know, baseless, unfounded charges. By law in America, there's very little a public official can do. The law says it's all in play. That's the outer boundary. At the other end of that spectrum are private individuals. In a series of cases after Sullivan, the Supreme Court basically enacted a much higher standard when you're writing about someone who is not a public figure. And in the extreme case where you're talking about someone who's a private person, which just means that they don't operate in the public domain, they don't have a public profile, they're not engaged on public issues, and the issue in question is private as well, say their health, to take a really easy example. So, you know, if I find out that one of you has cancer and I want to put it in the newspaper, that standard is very tight. And what the standard says is I have to be exactly right in the extreme case. Any error, truth is always an absolute defense. If it's true, it can always be in the newspaper. There's no standard beneath that as far as libel law goes. But for a private person, if I'm wrong at all, that's the other end of the legal spectrum, I'm in trouble. I'm liable for the damage that I've done to them. If I have caused damage to their reputation, if I've caused them emotional trauma, or caused them whatever, I'm liable for those damages. And in between those two poles is where, you know, there are a number of sort of midpoints that aren't particularly relevant right now, but basically set standards, you know, if it's, for example, a private person is engaged on an issue of public importance, the courts have established a standard called negligence, which basically means that I need to take reasonable care in ascertaining whether what I'm going to say about them is true. So this is the basic legal framework within which we do investigative journalism. And if we walk outside those boundaries, we face legal problems. And that's sort of the outer envelope of what we do. What I think I want to say about that right now is that, you know, this notion that things can be printed that aren't true is an interesting one. It's at the very bottom of what we do. Without it, journalism would be much harder, much less productive. Maybe in some senses that would be, you know, for some purposes that might be a better standard. It might, you know, if our error rate were lower, there would be advantages to that, clearly. But the standard that was enacted in American law, in distinction to English law and other legal systems around the world, was that it's okay to get it wrong sometimes. And, you know, the explanation that the Supreme Court has offered for that is quite simply that to be truthful all the time would constrain public discourse. It's not good for society to only allow the publication of true information, because it would make it too hard to talk productively amongst ourselves without the issues of the day. So, That's one interesting facet of this. And furthermore, you know, there's this very, in that Sullivan opinion that I referenced, there's a opinion from a justice named Brennan, in which he wrote that the importance of public discourse is such that if private people are sometimes embarrassed or maligned or even defamed, that is a cost that society ought to accept. that in the context of having a broad public discourse that issues of public importance, that type of collateral damage is okay. And that was the judgment of the court. And obviously you could reach very different judgments in other ethical contexts, but that is the judgment of the United States Supreme Court, which still is operative to this day about the boundaries of journalism. Now, I should say that we try not to press these boundaries. It's not our goal to be, you know, inaccurate or to publish rumors, but that's the outer limit that we begin with. And that limit, again, is mostly for public officials. So that's sort of, you know, where we begin. The second major set of laws within which investigative journalism happens in this country are laws about privacy. There is now in American law a formal concept of privacy. It's a pretty new concept. It was articulated by Justice Brandeis in the late 19th century, but it didn't enter into the law. It wasn't recognized by the Supreme Court until 1967. So very recently that we had in America a legal concept that people are entitled to some form of privacy, what is called, you know, the right to be left alone. And it has a couple of components that I'll just sort of fly through, some of which are pretty irrelevant for our purposes. So, for example, appropriation, which means I take a picture of you and I use it to advertise my product, and I don't compensate you for that, that's a violation of your privacy. Newspapers don't run into that, and in fact, the court has held that if you use a person's picture to sell newspapers, that's fine. That's not appropriation. That's protected speech. So we don't deal with this one. False light in the public eye, which is a very related issue, where I'm using your picture to illustrate something that is not true of you. So I take a picture of you and I say, you know, young hoodlums are running loose in the city. And the picture of it is of you standing at the train station, and you don't happen to be a young Muslim. That can be actionable. That's a form of violation of your privacy. I've cast you in a false light. Unreasonable intrusion is the third, and this starts to get into the territory in which I work. Unreasonable intrusion basically means getting information in a way that is problematic. So the classic example of this is wearing a wire. When you go into a private context and recording the person with whom you're speaking without their knowledge or consent, this can be legally problematic. And there have been a number of cases where journalists have done this. Tremendous journalistic effect, and in some of those cases the court has ruled that it's not okay. A famous example of this, one of the major television networks sent its reporters to work as employees at Food Lion, which is a big southern supermarket chain. They discovered disgusting things happening in the meat department. You know, rotting meat being trimmed and then re-presented to customers, meat being painted so that it would look fresher. Pretty much every horrible thing you can imagine was happening in the meat department. This seems to be entirely in the public interest. Why would the public not want to know that? Here was Food Lion essentially selling rotting food to people. But the way that they had obtained the information was by pretending, by getting hired by Food Lion and not telling Food Lion that they were in fact, I think it was Dateline, although I'm not sure, employees of one of the big network news shows. They went in, they got the information that way, and the court found that it had been an unreasonable intrusion, that being there under false pretenses in that way was ethically problematic, and that it was a violation of the privacy of Food Lion. So that's the third category of problematic conduct. And then the fourth, which is really the most relevant for journalism purposes, yeah.
Corporation that president?
Yeah, this is actually really interesting. So initially they didn't. Initially the court held in a series of cases that corporations had no expectation of privacy, and that the right of privacy as described by Brandeis was solely for people. But they've extended it. They've extended it over time to corporations. And there is now a right of corporate privacy, a right of control of the corporate domain, basically. Yeah, it's interesting that they've done that. And it's, you know, there certainly are people who wish they hadn't. So, yeah. The fourth category, which is by far the most relevant for journalism, is what's called public disclosure of private facts. And you want to parse that pretty carefully. There's a couple key parts there for our purposes. The public disclosure part was just stipulated. So it appears in the Washington Post, it's been publicly disclosed. Private fact is one key piece here. And the second is that the court has found that the private facts in question need to be highly offensive and objectionable. That's the phrase. So if no one knows that you have a baseball card collection, and I report that in the Washington Post, and you feel, you know, maligned by this, you'd probably have a hard time convincing the court that I had hurt you, damaged you, invaded your privacy, legally speaking. If, you know, I reported that, you know, well, imagine something you've done that's wrong and in your past, and it's not public knowledge, and it appears in the Washington Post, that could be actionable. There are a lot of constraints on this, and I just want to run through them to get a sense of how little actually constrains us legally in terms of what we do in journalism. So one of the famous cases here is a case called Philip. It's about a child prodigy, grew up here in Boston, was raised, enrolled in Harvard at age 11, spoke 8 languages, you know, wrote mathematics textbooks in Greek, for whose benefit I'm not sure. You know, genius guy who, as some geniuses are, was a little bit too close to madness and wandered off the rails and was found years later by a New Yorker reporter, even living in a tenement, think in the South End, you know, and the New Yorker ran this big profile of this guy, you know, sort of revisiting his life and looking at what had gone wrong with this guy who'd been so much in the spotlight when he was a child. The guy sued and said, I haven't been a public figure in 20 years. This is my private life. None of your business. It's none of your readers' business. There's no compelling public interest served by putting me back in the spotlight. I want to be left alone. I told you when you came to interview me that I wanted to be left alone. What are you doing, you know, making a fool out of me in the pages of the New Yorker? And the court basically said, I'm sorry, you're a public figure. You were a public figure for the purposes of your child prodigy-ness, as it were. You remain a public figure, revisiting your role as a public figure and asking, you know, where are they now, is a valid journalistic exercise. You wandered into the public domain when you were a child, and essentially your expectation of privacy was forever surrendered. So that's how fragile the definition of private figure is. Yeah.
He was a mother, and then once he became an adult, he chose to not be public figure. This past, his parents were choking him, driving him to the public right.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, the court, there's no notion of consent to being a public figure. So, for example, if you're the victim of an accident, you can become a public figure by virtue of having been hit by a car. You can be a public figure if you're the victim of a crime. You can be a public figure entirely without your consent. The courts don't recognize any notion of consent to being a public figure. So that case is a defining case, and what it basically says is, you know, if there is any reasonable sense in which a person has wandered into the public domain, they're fair game for journalistic purposes in a legal sense. You know, the court has gone even further than that and found that in defining the public domain, let's say, for example, that you, well, the case, there's a famous case called Cox Communications versus Cone. The victim of a rape. The record of the rape was filed at a county courthouse in Georgia. This is before the internet. There wasn't really any access to it. And the local television station broadcast news of it and named the victim of rape. And the victim sued and said, I'm a private person. This information was inaccessible to the general public unless they went to the courthouse and asked for it. You have broadcast it to my entire community. You've violated my privacy. You've defamed me. And the court held, which is sort of the second level of this, that if it was public in any sense, then broadening the circle of public knowledge did not constitute an invasion of privacy. And this same principle has been applied in other ways. So, for example, if you take trash out to the curb, and the trash contains your medical records or your prescriptions or other incriminating detritus, it has entered the public domain. You have broadcast it. And if I go into your trash bag and find it and share it with all of my readers, I have not legally done anything that is differentiated from the simple act you did by putting it into the public domain. I haven't gone any further, legally speaking. So it's an extremely broad exclusion. It means that almost nothing or many things that seem private by, you know, sort of the reasonable definitions that we might come up with are for legal purposes, in fact, not private. And then, you know, the court went even further and said, even if it's private, even your private and his private, if the discussion of you and your private information serves the public purpose, then there is an exclusion as well. So, and just dreaming up an example here, but, you know, this wasn't a law case, but, you know, there's a famous journalism ethics study when Arthur Ashe, in the early 1980s, a USA Today reporter found out that Arthur Ashe had AIDS, had contracted, I guess at that point, HIV, and called Ashe and said, basically, you know, we're going to report this. It was, you know, at that point, Ashe had retired from public life, so let's just grant, he probably was a public figure, but just for the purpose of this, say that he never happened. Clearly, medical information is one of the classic examples of private information. It was tightly held. It has not been in the public domain in any sense. The USA Today basically said, we think this has a public purpose. We think that we are bringing to light, you know, the extent of the AIDS epidemic. Ashe contracted it through a transfusion. That was an issue that was very much in the public light at that time. This is part of a public discourse about this disease. And that has, you know, legally speaking, a very solid foundation, that argument that you could take someone who's not in the public domain, who happens to be a blood transfusion recipient of the AIDS virus, and publicize that fact in the context of reporting on the epidemic. There's a very solid legal basis for doing that. Yeah.
The some of the newer laws about health information privacy.
Mm-hmm.
Are journalists constrained by those at all, or is that only employers and people who know it for other reasons?
We're constrained by them in terms of access. So they limit our ability to access information. Mm-hmm. But if we were able to obtain that information, they don't constrain publication.
Right. So if you were to get an information from a source who is constrained by, say, HIPAA,
yeah,
right, and then you were to publish it and it had their name on it,
mm-hmm,
they could then be prosecuted?
Yeah, this is the famous case of this is the Pentagon Papers case, where a guy named Daniel Ellsberg, who was a government employee, obtained information that was confidential, obtained it illegally. It was illegal for him to walk out of wherever he worked with that information. It was printed first by the Times, then by the Post, and the government went after the papers, and it went after him. And the court found that there's a different law that we're not going to get into today called prior restraint, which involves whether you can prevent a newspaper from publishing. They couldn't prevent the newspaper from publishing. They weren't liable for having published it. And Ellsberg's liability, I believe he was convicted. Do you remember? I think he was ultimately convicted for having obtained the information. So his liability was totally separate from the newspaper's liability. Obtaining confidential, if the other person has broken the law, the newspaper can do whatever it wants to.
Are there whistleblower laws protecting people who, you know, information which may be protected by statutes, but which is valuable to the public for some other reason? Are the laws protecting them?
No. It depends. I mean, there are whistleblower laws that do allow, under some circumstances, government employees to come forward, mm-hmm, and claim a privilege on the basis that they're exposing wrongdoing. But it is also the case that, you know, there's a long and distinguished list of people who have been prosecuted or penalized or punished for revealing information that was illegal or problematic for them to reveal. But no newspaper has ever gotten in trouble for publishing it, so long as the key requirement is you cannot compel them to have broken the law. So if I went to you, if you were a government employee, and I said, could you steal X for me, or could you bring me the following confidential information, I could be liable. You would then be my agent.
Okay.
But if you have done it already, and then come to me and said, I have this information, would you like to have it? There's nothing constraining my ability.
What about a case where I say, I can get this information if you want it?
One would need to construct their conversation very carefully.
Okay.
And we do.
Okay.
So you basically, you want to encourage the acquisition of the information without actually directing it. Think of a Shabbos court.
Yeah.
So the standard that I was talking about a second ago, this boundary of sort of private people being used as examples in the press, is very actively litigated right now. So it's not stable, but what I really want you to take away from these two discussions about libel law and about privacy law is that legally speaking, any boundaries on what journalism can and cannot do are extremely broad.
in general, we can do whatever we want to, as evidenced by the many publications that do all sorts of outrageous things on a daily basis, such as, you know, taking telephoto pictures of people, you know, inside their private houses and, you know, publishing people's medical records and their, you know, I mean, just all manner of extremely invasive material, you know, makes its way into publications. And legally speaking, there's almost nothing that can be done to constrain it. It is extremely rare for anyone to successfully win, to win a case against a media outlet for revealing personal information about them. So that's sort of the baseline here. Legally speaking, we're kind of on our own for the most part. As long as we don't aggressively, maliciously publish falsehoods about people, it's real difficult to constrain it. So that brings me to, the next phase of this, which is ethics. The rules that we actually apply to ourselves, the steps that we take to sort of limit ourselves within the context of the law. I want to just get back to where I started, which is to say that, you know, obviously, not all journalists live by any rule that I'm about to talk about. So that, you know, the range of journalistic practice extends clearly, evidently. One just needs to visit the supermarket to see this, right up to the legal extremes that I just outlined. Every day, in common practice. So the ethics that I'm going to talk about are, you know, specifically adhered to by a smaller community within the journalism world, which attempts to define itself in part through its adherence to these ethical principles as a matter of business, actually, as a matter of defining themselves as different than other media outlets and saying basically, you can trust us, you can rely on us, you can feel comfortable with us. These are the rules that we live by. And in particular, the major newspapers that many of you are familiar with, including the one that I work for, have a relationship with their readers that they perceive, that the newspapers perceive, as being based in part on these ethical principles. There are a couple of key ones. Well, I guess the other thing I should say by way of preface is that there's not a document written down anywhere at the Washington Post that articulates the principles that I'm about to tell you. It's not codified. It's not codified for two big reasons. The first is legal. There's a concern that if we write down the rules, we're essentially creating a standard against which we can be measured and found liable or wanted. The second issue is that it's not really, it's not fixed. It changes over time. It's a constant subject of discussion. It's not as if, you know, there's an original document to which we're attempting to interpret or adhere to. It's a flexible conversation about how we proceed between two very basic poles, one of which is, you know, the public interest in the ways that I defined it earlier, and the other is, you know, a respect for the people that we write about and for their privacy and for their interest in not being in the paper. And in fact, you know, there's a basic principle that informs this is what I guess I'd call, you know, informed consent, which is the notion that if you are not inherently the subject of a story, which is to say, you know, you're not the victim of the crash, you're not the public official who is, you know, making the decision about whether or not to allow development, we more or less grant you the right to decide whether you want to be the subject of a story. So if I'm writing about, you know, people who are losing their homes to foreclosure, my obligation, my bosses would not accept anything short of me obtaining the permission of the people that I'm writing about to portray them. Did they lose their homes to foreclosure? Yes. Is that a public record? Absolutely. Could I, in theory, within the confines of the law, publish that information and say, you know, Joe and Susan lost their homes to foreclosure. Here's their mortgage terms. Here's the amount of money they said they had on their mortgage application. There's all sorts of information that's in the public domain, but as a matter of practice, I need to obtain their consent. And not just to obtain their consent, but to obtain it on an informed basis. And again, these are not precise rules, but in general what that entails is going to them and saying, my name is Benjamin Applebaum. I'm a reporter with the Washington Post. I'm writing a story about people who have lost their homes to foreclosure. I would like to include you in that story. Are you willing to talk to me? So identification, statement of publication, statement of purpose,
you know, good understanding of why you're talking to them, who you are and why you're talking to them, and then the grant of permission for them to appear in the story. And this gets, this sounds like an easy principle, it gets really tricky, you know. Yeah.
That permission has to be, is it verbal or is it written?
Many television stations make a practice of obtaining written consent, and in some contexts, we will do the same thing. On longer-term projects, more involved projects, there may be situations in which we would attempt to obtain written consent. It depends extremely on the context. The closer you're getting to legal lines, the more carefully you may want to define those types of things. But generally, it's law. And, you know, I was writing about a couple. I sat with them for, you know, a lot of hours, reviewed their personal financial documents, heard a lot about the troubles that they were having, and you know, wrote a fairly detailed, revealing piece about them and their problems, and had the husband's, you know, complete permission to do it. And after the story ran, the wife called me in an absolute fury and said that she had not agreed to be portrayed in this way, and that, you know, she had not given her husband permission to speak on her behalf, and that I had violated, you know, their privacy. She didn't mean it in a legal sense, but, you know, that how dare I write about them without getting her to agree as well. This is a real problem, because it is often the case that a person is a participant in a family or in a community or in a group that has done something, and they are willing to characterize the experiences of that group, but some of the other members may not be willing to have it characterized. Irrespective of whether they want to talk to me, they may not want anyone to talk to me. And the rule that we generally operate by, and again, there's room for plenty of disagreement on whether this is the right rule, is that any member of the group can provide their own narrative, and to the extent that it inevitably touches on other members of the group, they own that narrative, and if they want to give it to us, they can. But that's one area into which we get into problems. The second is that many people change their minds. So you obtain someone's consent to write about them. You talk to them at great length. You are moving through the process of actually writing the piece, and they decide that they don't want to be written about. They talk to you of their own free will. And you know, there is a principle in journalism that we certainly apply to, say, public officials, that if you've said it, it's ours. We can do what we want to. It's not going to be taken back off the record. But there's certainly situations in which, as private people, we do back off and respect their privacy and allow them, really up to the moment of publication, to control whether or not they'll appear in the paper. So it's not just a question of informed consent at the outset, but even up to the moment of publication. I recently wrote an article in which I had interviewed a banker in Nebraska who had talked at some length about his relationship with federal regulators and described them in terms that are not particularly flattering, and called up in a panic the night before the story was going to run, called my editor and said, you can't use my name in this story. You can't quote me. It would ruin me. Please don't do it. With legally speaking, every right to quote him. Even in terms of the journalistic ethics that I think took a survey of 10 journalists and asked them whether they had a right to use that information, I think 10 of them would say yes. The person spoke to you, understood what they were doing, they're an adult, they made a choice, they need to live with it. My editors decided not to publish his remarks. The feeling was that while he was an adult and should have been prepared to live with the consequences, it was wrong for us to use him that way. We didn't need him enough to warrant the damage that it would do to him, separate from his choosing to have that damage done. I actually want to throw in the quotes. My editor made that cover.
Okay.
Yeah. Paper made that. Yeah. And that was a pure, you know, sort of a decision made on a purely ethical basis, that they just felt it was wrong. The final issue, which is extremely difficult, is what gets called in the context of medical research, the therapeutic misconception, which is when you go to a patient and you say, I'd like you to participate in a research project. we're investigating new treatments for diabetes. Most patients, whatever you say to them, have it firmly in their mind that if they participate in this trial, they may benefit, and their diabetes may get better. But the point of asking them to participate in the trial is to help them. And in fact, this is a profound misconception, because the point of medical research is to help other people who follow them. And in fact, some of the participants in the study are probably not even going to be getting the drug. We don't know if the drug works. It may have extremely harmful side effects. It's not good for you to participate in medical trials, at least not as such. And yet, most medical researchers tell us to some extent on that basis. Even the ones who don't are warring uphill against the fact that patients have a profound tendency to believe that it's going to help them. This is a basic problem with informed consent, is that people have fundamental misconceptions, a fundamental tendency to believe, to see things in terms of how it helps them, and to believe that it is helpful to them. And one would say that many journalists play off of this tendency in encouraging people to speak with them. But to move it into the journalistic domain, most people believe when they're talking to a reporter, they're doing it because they want to have their version of events or their opinion or their story reflected in the paper. They're doing it because they think it will be good for them. And reporters tend to encourage this impression and to encourage people to speak on the ground that they are sharing their story, their side of things, making sure that we have a complete account. In fact, our goal is not to help them. And while we may present a coherent version of their account, while there may be a coincidental confluence between their interests and ours, our primary goal is something else. Sometimes it may be to reveal something that they have done, to raise questions about it, at the very least to portray it as an example of something broader. They don't have control over the presentation, and a striking number of them regret it afterwards, feel misused by the way that they were quoted. This is such a common experience for journalists. It's kind of defining that when you call people back after a story has run and ask them how they felt about it, many of them are fine, many of them are happy, many of them are excited, but it is quite common to find that they feel, even if you quoted them accurately and in context, that in the context of the broader piece and its purpose, in retrospect, it didn't turn out the way they wanted or expected. So this misconception is profound, and it challenges our very ability to get informed consent. And it means that, you know, at the end of the day, you know, we are fundamentally still in the position of using people who, if they knew everything that we know, might not make that same choice. And the final related phenomenon is that we are often aware that if they participate, there will be consequences, or there are likely to be consequences, or there could be consequences, and they may not have properly weighted those consequences. The example of the person who provides this information and gets fired, whistleblowers tend to feel a sense of invulnerability. They tend to feel like they can get away with it. In fact, many of them don't. In fact, our hope is that when we publish it, we're going to do everything we can to make it as big a deal as possible, and that the consequences can be much more severe than they realize. Many whistleblowers are people who have been trying for years to get anyone to pay attention to something, and something that they believe is profoundly wrong and troubling. And they've developed over time a sense not only that no one is listening to them, but that no one really cares that they're saying it. And that therefore they can go on shouting it out with increasing force without ever really having to suffer the consequences that might happen if people did start listening. And if they convince us to put it in the Washington Post, it's rather good that someone will start listening, and then all of a sudden they're going to have, you know, a much greater focus and scrutiny on them than they might have realized. These are real ethical issues that we grapple with. And they do constrain the way that we approach subjects. But again, they're very malleable. They're not hard and fast lines, and none of them really gets into absolutes of you can't do that, it's illegal, or even it fundamentally violates the written principles of the Washington Post or of the journalism profession. That's the category of people who are in our stories voluntarily. There's obviously two other categories. The first is people who just happen to be there. They're the subject of the story inherently. It's their accident, their home that burned. They are the subject of a legal case. They are the business that has been stealing from people, whatever it is. And the one thing fully on in that context is an absolute right of response. The right to say what you want to about what we're going to write. And we go to great lengths to make sure that people have that opportunity. I've driven 3 hours just to stand outside someone's home, knock on their door, and shove a note through their mailbox, and then 3 hours back, just because I couldn't get the person on the phone, and I couldn't get any confirmation that they'd received the messages that I sent to them. We wanted to be sure that they had a chance. It was a story alleging that their company had been engaged in a massive financial fraud for which they were primarily responsible. We've been unable to contact them. We've been unable to, you know, if you all remember the backdating scandal of a couple of years ago, this issue of corporations essentially manipulating the financial results to reward executives. This was a company that I found that had clearly engaged in a pattern of backdating, a company called ScanForce in South Carolina. And it was clear that it happened. It was clear that the chief financial officer had been responsible for it, and I could not, not only could I not make contact with him, I couldn't convince myself that he was aware that I was trying to make contact with him. And what I ended up doing was driving 6 hours round trip to knock on his door at an hour when he should have been there, and to put a note through his door, you know, telling him who I was and what I was doing and how he could get in touch with me if he wanted to talk. I'm still frankly not sure whether or not he knew before the story ran that we were trying to get in touch with him. But,
Four days
out of the story. We'd also, you know, sent out a similar letter. We made a lot of attempts, but it's sometimes you go, if you try, and we'll really bend over backwards to do this. You know, sometimes even delaying a story, which is something that we hate to do because it creates the possibility that we're being manipulated, essentially by the refusal to respond. But that absolute right of response is true for everyone. It doesn't at all address the issue of privacy because, in fact, it invites them to increase their exposure, but it is one thing we do ethically to deal with that issue of invading people's lives is giving the opportunity to present what they have to say. And then, you know, obviously for public figures, and again, as we've talked about, that's a pretty broadly defined concept these days. There's no right to privacy, there's no right not to be in the story, and over time journalism has broadened the scope of mainstream journalism, so that group in the middle that wants to have ethical standards for itself has dramatically broadened the scope of what it considers relevant about these people. And I mean, I'm sure you all sort of heard these, you know, timelines of, you know, earlier presidents whose sex lives are considered absolutely not a subject for coverage and on through the present when, you know, the sex lives of presidential candidates are scrutinized very, very closely, and nearly anything of that kind is considered inherently a matter of public interest, and we're fine with publishing it. There are attempts to talk about why it is that we do that. You know, there are, you know, notions of, you know, sort of politicians have engaged in hypocrisy when it's fair game, or if, you know, speaks potentially to their motives in the things that they do and the decisions that they make, or it goes to a question of character. But fundamentally, the norm has become that anything about a politician that might be seen as damning by pretty much anyone has become fair game for mainstream publications. And so again, at that end of the spectrum where what we're really talking about is the broad and general public, the public figures, there are very few constraints on what we will and won't do. This puts us in an interesting position because it means that as journalists, we are spending a lot of time essentially choosing who to focus on and how much potentially to humiliate them. And it really, you know, less than we live in the context of ethical sort of absolutes and rules, there's no template, there are no arbiters, there's no rabbi to go ask what you should or shouldn't do. I mean, there are more experienced journalists in my newsroom and less experienced journalists, but there's no one whose authority is in any way endorsed by their position. There's no one who has, you know, some special status as far as arbitrating these disputes. At the end of the day, it's really a question of what you are comfortable with doing. And I know one of the questions that Rabbi Kapitsky does I talked about was what role one's personal compass has in the context of this profession. The answer is both a great deal and sometimes very little. On the one hand, at the end of the day, I'm primarily making my own judgments about what constitutes, reasonable intrusion into someone's life, what details about their life ought to be, matters of public record, when that type of intrusion is in the public interest for the purposes that we've talked about, for example, illustrating a subject of public debate. These discussions often happen with my editor or editors who may have their own viewpoints, and we argue it out, and ultimately they have veto power, but it's an extremely case-by-case judgment that we make, and it does depend a lot on my own personal feelings. There are reporters in my newsroom who don't do investigative journalism because it makes them so uncomfortable to be as intrusive as we sometimes are into people's lives. And they find other things to focus on and excel at. But this notion of, for example, one story that I worked on, I spent roughly 6 months trying to find people who would share with me, I've talked about this a little bit already, but, the details of their personal financial lives, what has gone so wrong with the way that they handled money? How are they spending it? How have they come to the brink of foreclosure? And this type of, tremendously intrusive, confrontational, because at some point, people don't tell the truth about themselves necessarily. If you're sitting there at their dining room table pressing them on, who it is who, has spent too much or what's going on in their personal lives or, is it medical issues that are causing all this money or what have you. I mean, these discussions become intensely personal and uncomfortable, and there are a lot of reporters who just personally choose not to do that kind of work. So there is a role for your own personal compass in that sense. At the same time, what journalists honor, the work that papers want, the work that readers seem to want, does require driving up to the edge of this envelope and pushing the boundaries, and that is generally speaking rewarded. The reason is the definition of what is acceptable journalistic practice has expanded over time is that, for example, readers proved tremendously interested in the details of the private lives of politicians, tremendously interested in a greater understanding about the way that ordinary people live and act. No journalist seriously questions whether a story about a trend is better or worse if it contains detailed portraits of real people. We accept this as a basic premise. That if you can get people in your stories and use them as illustrations and fundamentally invade their privacy and put them on a public stage, that type of journalism is more valuable, more worthwhile, more impactful, more interesting to readers than simply writing about an issue. My first major investigative project was an exploration of lending discrimination, looking at differentials in the interest rates charged to minorities and whites by the same lenders, people with, identical financial profiles, similar incomes, similar credit scores, similar jobs, living in similar neighborhoods, showing statistically that being a minority appears to be the determining factor in why you were charged the higher interest rate on your loan. And I did this story from a distance. I came to journalism, with much more of an interest in sort of public policy than in narrative as such or, people's lives as such. I have colleagues who see everything in terms of specific anecdotes. I tend to see things in terms of themes and issues. And I wrote this story from that perspective as an analysis of data and as a discussion of the questions raised by the data. And the lead said something like, African Americans making more than $100,000, living in, affluent neighborhoods, they're more than five times as likely as whites living in those same neighborhoods and making exactly as much money to get high-priced mortgage loans. It felt to me very powerful and very damning. It was an evidence-based piece that didn't invade anyone's personal life, and it sunk more or less without a trace.
It did not grab readers. It did not communicate what I wanted it to communicate, which is that something outrageous was occurring. It didn't work as a piece of writing. My next major series was in a similar vein, building on that work to look at the consequences of some of that lending. What happened to the people who had gotten these high-rate loans? It turned out that many of them had become some of the early victims of this foreclosure crisis. And that story began with something like, you know, Joe and Jane Seymour took out a loan 4 years ago that they knew they couldn't afford. And that story was very much about them and about other people who had lived the specific experience of being discriminated against and ending up in financial situations that were devastating to them. It required them to open up their private lives deeply and entirely, I think in most cases without understanding what the consequences would be. As an act of faith in me and my representation to them, that, and I tried to tell them this wasn't going to be good for them, it would be good for other people, and I think some of them understood that and some of them didn't, but ultimately, you know, it required an invasion of their privacy, an exposure of their own failings and problems and shortcomings and poor decisions, and it went off like a bomb. And had tremendous impact and resulted in tremendous consequences. And I really think much of the difference was the use of private lives to illustrate public issues. So we accepted the principle that that's a necessary thing. Yeah.
How do you trace those consequences if they had such a profound impact on the public?
That's it.
Or any funding like
that? Yeah, you know, there's a couple of different ways. I mean, one is just a question of response. People who call and email or talk about it in other forums, the extent to which other publications begin to cover that issue or carry your coverage of that issue. Some of it is a question, when I am working on a piece of investigative journalism, one thing that I generally do at the outset is sit down and think about what I'm trying to accomplish. In the case of that piece, for example, the three things that I hoped to have happen were I wanted to put the mortgage company in question out of business. I wanted the state to change its laws to prevent that from ever happening again. And I hoped that there would be some sort of settlement that would provide restitution to the victims. Those are my three goals in writing that piece. A lot to ask of a piece of writing, but those are the goals. And it did all three of those things. That mortgage company was put out of business by regulators. The state changed its laws within the year. And actually, pretty recently, they announced a major settlement for the victims. So, ultimately, that's how I measure the success.
And if those goals wouldn't have been met, would you consider that piece unsuccessful or ineffective?
Yeah, I would have. Yeah, I mean, it could have met, it could have achieved other lesser things. Public awareness, education, momentum toward those changes. Kind of a step along the road.
And just as an effective as the piece before that was doing the president.
These are imprecise measurements. I mean, it's there's no absolute system for quantifying the impact of a piece of work. It's lucky when there are clear results that one can look at and say that achieved X or Y or Z. A lot of times it's a lot more imprecise than that. It's just a sense of, you know, greater response or greater awareness around an issue, or you need to write 300 or 400 pieces about something before anything changes, and it may not have even changed because of anything that you said. So objective exact measurements are pretty tricky. Okay.
Do many pieces that you or Jeffers in general have concrete goals? Is there kind of something special about this? Given the, you know, non-success of your earlier
pieces? It's interesting, you know, I've worked with an editor who is of the opinion that much of investigative journalism is a giant waste of time because it doesn't have a clear enough sense of what it is hoping to achieve. So, you know, she's fond of saying, you know, she often judges contests for journalists and that's the best work, and she'll say, you know, I read so many pieces that are, you know, they're beautifully written and they prove exactly the thesis that they articulate at the outset is in fact happening. And I walk away thinking, who the hell cares? This has not been a force for change. This has not articulated a purpose. It is not clear what they wanted to happen as a result of publishing this information. So I think the best investigative journalism is defined by its agenda, by its ability to force change or cement change. And absent that purpose and that execution, it's just entertainment at best. But it's by no means the case that every piece achieves that.
Would you then say, absent those, and again, whether it's excuse or not, a conscious and honest effort to achieve those goals, but without those goals, would that change ethical considerations in terms of, you know, the process of the research and
yeah, there's no question that both the law and journalism honor a principle that the ends can justify the means. So that, you know, legally speaking, for example, in the context of invasion of privacy, the courts have explicitly created a test of public purpose. And I was talking earlier about this notion, this case that asked the question of, is this relevant to a discussion of public importance? That's extremely broadly interpreted, and that in fact, you know, as I suggested, you know, even if something is private, and disclosing it as defamatory, it damages the reputation of the person about whom it is concerned. If it serves a sufficient public purpose, the courts may still find that that means, which was otherwise prohibited, is nonetheless justified by the ends that are served. And ethically, we certainly honor this principle as well, so that, you know, if we believe that a subject is of sufficient public importance, whatever that subject may be, let's say it's, you know, teen drinking or, you know, promiscuity or, you know, whatever it is, going out and revealing stories about people who are engaged in that behavior gains a sense of utility that it wouldn't otherwise have, and without that sense of utility it wouldn't appear in our cases. So it is absolutely the case that that is a defining question in terms of what we will and won't do.
Is publicity a goal in and of itself?
Is publicity a goal in and of itself? Not publicity, but...
Or putting it in the public domain, yeah.
It can be. I mean, it can be, yeah. I mean, it sometimes, often I think, what we are trying to do is to broaden the circle of awareness of a particular fact or set of facts or a narrative that we think ought to be familiar to more people than it is. Mm-hmm. And it's a very basic purpose in journalism is to take things that are only known to a few people and to bring them to the attention of a lot more people to whom they would be extremely relevant. I think that almost defines a lot of investigative journalism. I mean, we sometimes are engaged in the creation of knowledge. We sometimes are engaged in original research of various kinds, whether that consists of, you know, data work, bringing together, correlating, uncovering things not previously known. We sometimes are engaged in the analysis of information, presenting things in a new light or helping people see them in a way that they haven't before. But I think probably most often we're engaged simply in the dissemination of information, making it available to a broader group than previously had access to it. That's probably the majority of the work that gets done under the banner of investigative journalism. The Pentagon Papers would be a famous example of that. The act of journalism in that case literally consisted of the verbatim republication of a massive federal document. And, you know, there was no reporting in the sense of calling people up and asking them what they thought about it or interpreting it, or, you know, that all came later, but the celebrated act, the thing that journalists regard as one of their great triumphs, was the simple act of republication of a classified document in the broadest possible form. And that, I think, is something we still do as a primary function.
And so those, let's say those other goals we have for that people in the ministry.
Mm-hmm.
So what you didn't feel comfortable enough to say this is just something that the public needs to know?
No, to the contrary. I felt so comfortable that I felt that the information needed to accomplish more than that. I said that once the public was aware of these facts, it would be inevitable that regulators would act because the company was clearly breaking the law, and it should be inevitable that legislators, and to the extent that the company wasn't breaking the law but was simply engaging in practices that were horribly harmful and predatory, that the law should be changed so that that type of conduct was illegal, and the victims ought to receive restitution. It, sometimes, because when you're disseminating, for the most part, my job, one thing I'm in theory supposed to be good at, is making things accessible and interesting that might not otherwise be. I'm a translator and an interpreter in that role, and ultimately a storyteller. And if I have not, if it doesn't have that effect, I see it as a judgment on my storytelling. I see it as a judgment on the way that I communicated the information, because it's relevant. It's clear to me. I know what I would do if I were in charge and had learned those things. So my goal is to say it in a way that compels the same conclusion on the part of my audience. If I haven't done that, you know, simple dissemination, there's no separation between those two things in my mind. If the dissemination doesn't result in the consequences, then the dissemination is flawed in that sense. Yeah.
So, it's my understanding that most of the stuff that's in the newspaper and investigative journalism and one year.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. So, you know, I said at the outset that, you know, when we talk about journalism and ask the question of what gets into the paper, in sort of the broadest sense that gets defined in terms of the public impact, again, there's two branches to that. It's a double entendre almost. You know, you've got what interests the public and what's good for them. And I think, you know, broadly speaking, anything in a given newspaper falls into one of those two categories. It's either entertaining or it's wholesome. And the intent is, you know, for it to fall into one of those two categories. And many things are combinations of it. So if you're thinking about, you know, there's no such thing as pure investigative journalism. There's not too much that's purely entertaining. There's hopefully not too much that's just purely wholesome. These categories overlap extensively. So, you know, investigative pieces attempts to be entertaining to some extent as well, engaging, interesting. Entertaining pieces attempt to have some measure of social value. But a lot of what gets into the paper, the distinction I was drawing earlier I think is important here. If you want to talk about investigative journalism in terms of going out and finding things that are not otherwise publicly available, much of what's in the paper is stuff that is publicly available in one form or another. It is either an event that has transpired, and we are sharing with readers who are not present or who did not appreciate its significance or its consequences, or it is something that has been brought to our attention by someone else, or it is a venue for discussion and argument. Much of it is more accessible than the stuff that is brought to life by investigative journalism. But there's no question that investigative journalism is a real minority of what we do. To give you sort of a sense of that, you know, there are 600 journalists in the Washington Post newsroom, and I would say that 2 to 3 dozen of them are employed full-time in something that would be tightly defined as investigative journalism. Many others do it intermittently or in the context of other responsibilities. Some stories include elements of investigative journalism, but it's a small part of the broader enterprise. We have many more people engaged in covering sports, for example.
But I guess in a perfect world where entertainment wasn't necessary.
I don't know that would be a perfect world, but let's accept the premise for a moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the other one.
Yeah.
Would you rather that?
Would I rather that personally? No, I like being entertained sometimes.
Like, are the entertainment and that's valuable because no one needs to buy the papers? Or is it entertainment that's valuable because people need to know it?
I think that sugar-coated pills are a wonderful invention. And they serve a real social purpose because none of us really wants to eat gruel all the time. And so food is tasty because it is most effective when it is tasty. It's a means of encouraging us to consume it and to digest it. And there's no question that our ability to eat is increased by the quality and flavor of the food, and we can eat more and consume more when that's true. So, you know, there's this, there's a new autobiography of, not autobiography, of John Stuart Mill, who started to live in the kind of world that you're describing, and then fell in love. It's a very interesting book, but, you know, he thought that society was headed toward where you want it to go. And, no, but I mean, but he, and he saw that as a good thing, and, you know, it's a particular vision of utopia that I'm not sure.
That's fine. That's just, but they are still,
yeah, you know, absolutely.
I mean, but the pill state, there's still in your mind some specific person.
Not every element of the newspaper. I mean, it's a bazaar. It's a department store. That's one of the reasons we're in so much trouble.
But the pill is a specific article, I'm sure.
Both. There is both a package, a broad package of newspaper, a department store of information in which, you know, there are sections that are almost wholly devoid of nutritional value, and the comics come to mind, and there are you know, elements of the paper then that are almost wholly informational, like the stock tables, and a lot of stuff that falls in between, and I think that in general we have found that we are most effective, which is a little bit what I was describing to you before, when we manage to entertain people while communicating with them. That is generally what we aspire to do, is to write articles that are both entertaining and informative. There's not, the best investigative pieces are not wholly dry and, you know, without entertainment, because the constituency for that type of work is very small. The reason that I'm a journalist and not an academic is that I wanted to talk to a lot of people, as many as possible. And to tell them things that they wouldn't otherwise know. And I found that, and this has been a process of growing up for me. When I started in journalism, I didn't accept as fully the need to do that by breaking it down and making it simple and, you know, putting it into allegory and metaphor and, you know, using every possible tool to get it across to the many people out there who will not voluntarily think about anything, may not have the capacity to think about very much, but do need to be informed against their will without them knowing it along the way between the sports section and the comics.
I understand part of your concern about that stuff, but what about the kind of story that says, you know, someone was arrested for manslaughter today.
Mm-hmm.
He lived alone. No one cares.
Mm-hmm. What's the value of
them? Well, is that entertainment? You know, the shooter codes, you know, that allows people to pick up the paper and say, oh, I'm interested in this, so I was kind of...
No, I would, I mean, I don't want to speak for people who find that entertaining, but I think that it's a question, it's a good question, and I think that a lot of stuff gets in the paper by rote, because we've always covered it. So, you know, there's, someone decided long ago that, you know, every murder needs to be in the paper, but the public purpose that serves over time is to make people aware of the number of murders in their community, you know, to create a continuing record of violence transpiring in that community, to say, you know, by the way, you may just notice this, you passed out that someone else got shot last night, and maybe you glanced at it and noticed it's in the same neighborhood that someone got shot the night before, and occasionally you come back to that, and you create the body of knowledge, even if it's not, you know, for the individual, that, you know, someone can go back eventually and say, look, this is the only record of every murder that happened in that city that year. Now let's draw broader lessons from it. So it's what we call journalism of record. It's the creation of a document, a reference document, that people can return to, and even if its utility is not apparent at the time of its creation, to some extent we act on faith in putting it on record, in the hope and the belief, and frankly in the repeated experience that eventually much of it does have utility to readers.
But isn't that kind of dangerous? Because oftentimes what ends up happening is, you know, not every murder is covered. Mm-hmm. In fact, every murder of a middle-class white person is covered. And it creates, you know, it can create, because there's not a systematic plan to cover every murder, mm-hmm. it's just the ones that catch people's eyes, which are middle-class white people near their homes,
right,
gets covered. And you've got this every story is totally correct, and there's nothing wrong with publishing any of those stories, but you end up building up a false perception that either there isn't really much of a problem except for occasional random murder, or if it happens somewhat more frequently, there's a serious problem of middle-class white people being murdered near their homes when there isn't actually, but there's a serious problem of violence in the inner city, which isn't getting covered because that's taken as normal, right? But I just wonder, this is more of a question for an editor, I guess, than someone who's actually doing the coverage because you don't have control over. But, how do those kinds of things get avoided? And to my sense, they largely happen by accident because of the side of the public interest, which is what people are interested in.
It's a really important issue, and it goes to the heart of, and journalism's great sort of conceit, which is that we deal in objectivity, that we're producing a document that reflects some, considered dispassionate judgment about what people ought to know, and that it is not influenced by our personal experiences or biases, very formulated as, it shouldn't be obvious to the reader. The reader shouldn't care who wrote the article. It shouldn't have any impact on the way the article came out. This is crazy. It's an illusion. It doesn't exist. Many forms of journalism have strived without this principle even as a goal. But where, the point of it is to strive towards that goal. They basically, not that we're going to succeed in erasing our tendency to be most concerned about the murder of people that look like us in neighborhoods, where we live or imagine that we should live. I would imagine, I don't know if it's four newspapers, I can't speak for every newspaper in America, but the four newspapers where I've worked, it tended to be the case that most of the editors lived in the same part of town. And it was a running joke in all four newsrooms that they were intensely concerned that the paper should devote more coverage to the quality of the roads in that part of town. Because clearly that's what people wanted to know about, and they knew this because that's what the people they knew wanted to know about. And so, this is like the phenomenon, when I was a kid in Newton, it was discovered that the snowplows were going first to the streets where the city council members were. No time, no speech first. So this is a problem in the world. It happens. It's a problem that newsrooms think about and try to deal with, through diversifying the voices that participate in these decisions. They think about it consciously in terms of, sort of questioning why these judgments are made. It is absolutely the goal to move past the point where, conscious bias is influencing decisions about who gets murdered, to at least articulate the question, what ought we to be saying about murder patterns in this city? What are the real lessons here? Where should people be focused? What attention should be focused on it? So that at least you're having that discussion and you're hoping to reach answers that are, at least headed in the right direction and to make explicit those implicit choices. But you're also right to note that a lot of this happens through inertia, through the fact that there's a paper produced every 24 hours, and frankly, in the internet era, much more quickly than that, and that a lot of this just happens because it's available, or it's easy, or it's popular, or it's, the default, or it's, the way things have always been done, and that can create hugely misleading impressions. I mean, there's no question, for example, that, there was a crash on the DC metro system a couple weeks ago, and 9 people were killed. And I had at least 4 calls in the first hour after that crash from friends who wanted to know if I was okay, but I didn't, on the train. Very nice of them. I have never been called by a friend to ask whether I was involved in a fatal crash on the highway around Washington. Why is that? More people die there by a wide margin than ever died on the train. But, in part, the coverage of these train crashes is so huge. It appeared on the front page. It appeared on the front page in New York, in Los Angeles. We've created a bias toward big events. It exists naturally, but the media tends to accentuate that bias toward believing that big events are more important than trends over time.
And it's a real problem with the media that, you know, that type of disproportionate coverage for the individual event creates an impression or reinforces an impression in the public mind that individual episodes of particular problems are much more important than they are. So that, you know, Florence will get a lot of coverage, but, you know, influenza every winter does not. And influenza every winter kills tens of thousands of people. Florence was killed, I don't know, a parent or a couple thousand, and we're obsessed with it. So these biases do work themselves through our coverage. They're real issues. And the only thing I can tell you that's even minorly redeeming is that there is conversation about it. There's an attempt to be aware of it and to think about it, and that often fails to accomplish anything.
I wonder if you could maybe go through the timeline of one of these 24-hour stories, and if you could explain kind of what sorts of considerations that you would make in a story that you had a longer period of time that you can't do because of time.
That's a great question. The 24 hours is actually longer than it generally, for a daily story. The shortest version of the story that ends up in the paper is that I arrive at the office. The shortest version is that something happens at 5 p.m. and deadline at 7 p.m. and I need to write it while I record it. And in those circumstances, one is extremely guided by the availability of information. So people whose cell phones I have are more likely to be called than people whose cell phones I don't have. People who email to offer themselves up as experts on the subject at hand have an upper hand over people who I need to reach out to, and so forth. I mean, within limits, you know, but there's no question that the form that a story takes under that type of pressure is extremely influenced by availability. And at the other end of the spectrum, when I have a year to work on a story, you know, that I think much more carefully about what information I want in an ideal world and then go out and seek to obtain it, even if, you know, in terms of time, doing so would be prohibitive in other contexts. So the major difference on the spectrum is basically, you know, you can spend time to get particular information, and if you don't have that time, then you make do with the information that is available to you. It's the case more broadly, however, that, you know, in terms of some of the considerations that we've been talking about here, that the layers start to peel back in terms of the amount of deference and courtesy and whatever that you can extend to people when you're under deadline pressure. So, you know, on a longer-term story, I almost always call back the subject of the story before it appears, talk with them about how they're going to be presented and what exactly I'm quoting them as saying, and to hear from them any, you know, final objections or concerns that they may have. On a one-day story, that doesn't happen. You know, it is the case that, you know, if there were time, you know, for example, I'll give you actually a real-life example. A friend of mine, a reporter at the Globe, was covering a crash involving a driver on the T, I guess this is more than a year ago now, was working on deadline, and one thing that's really transformed actually privacy expectations, if you haven't noticed talking about today, is the internet. Because it's a very strange place where people operate as if they were in amongst friends, and share things that one historically would have shared only in a room with other friends. But in fact, it is publicly accessible. And they may realize that and not care, or they may not realize that. But, you know, it is one of the first things that journalists now do after, you know, someone goes off and kills people or does something else crazy or becomes a public figure, is we all race to find the Facebook page before it gets removed. Because people say the damnedest things on the Facebook page. And they reveal things about themselves that one would not know otherwise. And you know, in this case, the driver was, it turned out he was transsexual and was a member of a community online devoted to that. And this information about him, which was not at all relevant to the crash, you know, became a subject of coverage. Not in the Globe and some other publications, but it was written about extensively because it was out there, it was public, it was known, it was available, and it created a real issue, and it happened very quickly after the crash. It was found, it became an issue, etc. And, you know, there was this pressure to sort of flesh out the portrait of this guy, and this friend of mine was reaching out to his friend, to the friend of the driver through Facebook, sending an email saying, "I've been walking the board, I'm working on this story about this guy, I'm trying to present a full picture of him, you know, would you please talk to me?" And at that moment, there was such anger about these revelations, about the sensational turn that the coverage had taken, that very few of the person's friends were willing to talk to a reporter. Well, you know, in terms of producing a fair, complete, interesting portrait of the guy, what was really needed was another week. What happened is that there was no time available. It needed to be in the next day's paper, and the coverage of this guy focused overwhelmingly on this one, frankly, irrelevant fact about him. And so what you get in that time-pressured context are huge distortions of the importance of the aspects of the story, based primarily on, again, the availability of information. It erodes our ability to check if things are true, because we just don't have time. It erodes our ability to pursue more difficult angles or more complete perspectives or to ruminate, which can be extremely important in thinking about how you want to present something. I find, much to my editor's frustration, that I do some of my best work in the moments after I turn in my story, because I suddenly have the clarity of thought to realize what I should have done. That's great on longer-term pieces, because I've learned that the thing to do is to set a deadline and turn it in, and then go to the editor and say, "I need it back," and that works. But if something happened at noon, and I'm supposed to file by 7 p.m., and the press is start running at 9:30, there's not a lot of time for that, and what gets lost is a lot of that sort of considered reflection.
You think that the world would be a better place if there were no internet
and
all newspapers were weekly?
that's a really interesting question. I read the internet, and I sometimes, I mean, we all read on the internet. There are things about it that I really like, and there are things about it that I find addictive in the extremely unhealthy sense of that word. Compulsive, sort of like just getting information because it's available. One thing that some media scholars have written about is that some of what happens on the internet is that, human appetites tend toward, just wanting more of what's available, and you can fascinate people with content is absolutely meaningless, and keep them in a thrall for hours without ever edifying them in the slightest. And so I have real apprehensions about that in one sense, but it's like, I worry about the things I can control in life, I guess, and this clearly is not one of them, so it's almost like, let's say we granted that the world would be a better place if we all thought before we spoke and, wrote and reflected and then rewrote before we submitted. So we don't get to live that. So I think it's a really interesting question.
The whole thing, actually. Well, that's been actually interesting because I saw this senior class again this year. And Thomas and Rob, they went to Western School. But one of the body experiments we kept getting back to was, would the world exactly be a better place if not ever is? Anyone else want to
hate it? Yeah, you lose the virtue of spontaneity.
Do you think that any of the, either the cultural or social exposure to the volition out of the event, growing up, and affect the way you approach these questions?
I do. I think that in general, my upbringing affects my work greatly. I think it reinforces my predisposition to view things in terms of the issue rather than the people. I think my sense of what constitutes substantive work and an acceptable way to spend one's time is strongly influenced by my opinions. I am puzzled by, I have colleagues who spend their days going around trying to learn,
led dinner with him, and you know, frankly, I'm a little bit puzzled by it. I think they're not very good people. So yeah, I mean, I do think that it affects my view of that. You know, it's interesting. Maybe this is a function of ego. You know, Bolsonaro is something that I don't know that it numbered in the top 20 of the concepts that got sort of really talked about seriously as focuses of the practice of our Judaism. You know, as in terms of like, what are we actually going to think about how we do it, and you know, its relevance to life. It's one of these things that's on or on the breach and talked about not very much. And so, you know, in some sense, I think that particular set of laws is not as influential. I think, you know, the influence comes more, it's like one of those things that you hear about, you'd be like, well, that's wildly impractical. You know, that's certainly not how people behave in school. So it kind of felt anachronistic. But the broader ethical influence is, I think, more important than the specific influence of the question.
I mean, as you were saying, if we're willing to put in the story about the financial decisions of these bankruptcy in the context of helping people understand that predatory lending practices have consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually is a challenge for you that you put in the slide today. I mean, I listened to the NPR report doing the exact same thing a week ago and wasn't quite sure. Even though the person kept saying I consented to this, it wasn't at all clear to me that I was not being the person in being that was but certainly there are sorts of mistakes that invest in things to trivial purposes. So what is it that the reporters who are mediocre have the option of choosing your story for them?
Not very much if they want to stay in the business. There is, it's a really good way of putting it. My ability to make choices, my ability to control what I work on to the extent that I'm able to do so, is almost entirely dependent on my ability to produce, albeit on my own terms, work that the paper regards as stellar. And if I were not able to do that, my time would be much more in the service of my editor's whims. And the final product would be much more shaped by their desires as well. You know, when I turn in a story, the editing process is collaborative, and how much it changes depends on how well I've written it and how well I've anticipated, at least to some extent, or agreed upon the direction for the story. But what appears in the paper is, in the first place, remains under my intellectual control, and in the second place, you know, reflects substantially my desires. That's not necessarily true for every reporter. There are reporters who are essentially in the business of bringing back information so that editors can craft from it a story that they find interesting. There are reporters who work under more direct orders from their editors. The question of how much autonomy an individual reporter has, it really varies widely. And there certainly are people in my newsroom, and kind of a little bit puzzling, but, you know, for everything they can say, you know, journalism's a job for them, more than a calling, and it's a pretty terrible job, so I'm not sure why they want it. But they, you know, follow orders, you know, and submit what they're told to, and if they were told to go out and start writing, you know, pieces about, you know, how stupid public law, that would be what they'd have to go do.
I'm wondering, part of the issue is one of the questions I'm trying to develop is that it's really kind of a luxury. Unless the profession is really generally guided by the idea that it's supposed to be, that you get to do things in kind of any form of context of it.
But
if it turns out you're a mediocre, you're going to be writing the story that Michael Jackson's hairdresser.
Close, and one always has a choice about whether or not to be a journalist. So, I mean, in that sense, one could construct ethics as
you know, binding and absolute, and say that those who want to walk below whatever ethical line one has defined are engaged in a transgression based on their opportunity to go do something else with their lives. But those are not acceptable choices, but there's always the either or of, are you still in journalism? Within the context of journalism, I think it's certainly true that there is such a wide spectrum of accepted practice that it is very difficult to argue that we have any sort of codified ethical standards that, you know, extend any particular distance beyond the legal boundaries. So I agree with that premise. It is true in the context of a newsroom like the one at the Washington Post, which admittedly you need to get there, but it is acceptable at any time. There are a certain number of things that one can always say to an editor that are considered valid responses, you know, such as, well, obviously that's not true, but also, you know, to assert that a piece is not balanced, to assert that a piece is not based on, you know, a complete picture of what transpires, to assert that a piece is not fair to the subject, that they've not had an adequate opportunity to respond. The issues that I talked about here, you know, the ethical principles that you know, define my own reporting, are, in many of them, are things that any reporter could insist upon, and that no editor at the Post would be able to insist upon transgression. And that, you know, sufficiently define that community, and beyond the Post as well, a community of a certain number of newspapers, they are defensible principles within that world, and one can insist on living by them without directly endangering one's career.
The one issue that I'm pushing on, but
yeah,
you decided to serve the public interest,
mm-hmm,
and you adopted how you balance the interest of privacy,
mm-hmm,
against the public interest. So the question is, when the public interest is the current interest as opposed to the substantive interest, does someone public interest in the intercession knowing they're never going to make a Washington Post?
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be a journeyman reporter who gets sent out to do stories that embarrass people unless I think it's a substantive interest.
Yeah, they will, and the Post is the wrong line, because we have people who are wholly engaged in the business of brilliant journalism. I mean, that, as I suggested earlier, I mean, I have some colleagues who seem to do nothing but embarrass people for no good reason. I mean, that's their job. Yes, for example, you know, or our Hollywood reporters, or, you know, the folks who cover, you know, whatever it is, like, you know, there are people who are more or less fully engaged in that business at the highest levels, as it were, of, you know, voyeuristic journalism. So it's not, and conversely, there are people at very small newspapers whose careers are defined by writing about substantive issues. There's silos more than strata. It's not a question of where you work, nor is it a question of everyone being able to succeed. It's not as if that's a sure route, that if you just start writing about, you know, sensational things, that will necessarily propel your career. The criteria for success along both axes have much more to do with how well you do those things. So I don't know that it operates in the manner that you're describing, that there's any sort of tendency to compel reporters who are not sufficiently good at writing about matters of substance to go write about matters of, you know, complete saltiness. To the contrary, you know, people aren't very good about writing about matters of substance, tend to get stranded at whatever level they were working at, and, you know, are either hired or fired based on their ability to hold their own at that level. There's no tilt in the playing field, per se, that I've observed. It is true that the scale of journalism on, you know, celebrities and on, you know, those kinds of issues has dramatically expanded, and so there are relatively more opportunities in that area, and people who think that that's a valid way to spend their lives could certainly choose to pursue those opportunities more easily. There are many fewer opportunities in journalism to do substantive work. It's a much smaller field. It's much harder to advance, probably, although the competition on the other side may be, I don't know what the proportions of competition are, but it's a much smaller field, and so it's much harder to get to the top of it, perhaps. But it's not that one is, I don't even particularly observe a lot of movement between the two fields. They're kind of cousins and fellow travelers, but not exactly
two halves of the same whole.
Two questions of the consequences are the most formula. I'm not asking you, but I don't think it's an ideal answer, but I want to know what the formulations are.
Okay.
So the first is, what happens if the exposure of privacy of somebody is helpful, not to the substance of the story, but it just adds the entertainment value of the story, which you think is substantively important? Right? That's a different calculation, right? If you could tell the story of Joanne, that Joanne M. Seymour, whatever it may be, and really, the story of Joanne Seymour is tangential. But people will read the piece if you can start a really cool story that you can follow. Of course, Joanne Seymour are not typical, but there are many other people who are. Right? So either the same calculation just gives us, will the story be effective or not, or does the substantive relationship of the private information to the story really matter?
You know, I think I would probably answer that by saying that its effectiveness depends on the relationship. That to write an anecdote purely by means of the technical term for that is a bait and switch. That's what we call that type of approach, where you let people into the story based on something, you know, really interesting, and then you say, you know, by the way, this isn't really representative of what I'm writing about, but, you know, I've shown you that I'm entertaining, maybe you'd like to come along for the rest of the ride. It doesn't work. As a matter of effect, I really question whether that's ever an effective strategy for engaging a reader. The disappointment inherent in finding out that the example isn't actually the subject, I think, is the overwhelming response. And so just on grounds of effectiveness, that's an approach that one probably would be advised against pursuing. That said, if one believed, just to take it as a hypothetical, that that was effective, would that be justified? It's an interesting question. I think that, you know, subject to some of the notions we talked about the willingness of the individual to participate, there probably would be some level of tolerance for it. In my own journalism, I really try, for reasons of effectiveness primarily, but secondarily because when I push in this direction, my mind it makes me uncomfortable. I would always want an example that had substantive relevance to matter at hand. And if I didn't think that was effective, I'd sort of hypothetical I can't deal with. But in the context of a newsroom, it's clear to me that does sometimes happen, that the entertainment value of an anecdote can be sufficient to warrant inclusion for the purpose of embroidering, you know, something else. Any single consequences from partisanship. So this, you know, gets back to the question of objectivity. And one thing to understand about investigative journalism is it is inherently not objective. I am a partisan when I write. I would differentiate between partisanship in the sense of adherence to a cause and then service of that cause by going out and trying to find issues that are in furtherance of the cause. Or approaching the question of what I write about through the lens of, you know, advancing the interest of a political party or of some other group. But when I have found something that is wrong, I'm a partisan in the service of correcting it. My goal is not to, you know, present an even-handed account of why it might be okay or why it might not be okay. I want to write as clearly as possible about why it's wrong. The pursuit of consequences is very much in engagement with whatever the issue is. And by nature, that type of engagement is part of it.
That's immediate consequence. Right. You know, the voting, you know, criticism, you know, you imagine you're still
Democratic,
or you're still liberal.
I would define myself as a liberal with a small L. Let's put it that way.
That's right. What's some cause that you have an important political body that's equally divided, and you discover a scandal, you know, that will force on all this, that will tip the balance of their administration equally, but the thing that makes a difference is who is in charge.
It's a particularly interesting question in the context of writing about a scandal that would oppose your political interest. So, you know, I think any journalist can sort of, you know, find their way through the ethical woods on the question of, is it okay to write about a scandal that would help the people that you like?
Sure, yeah, why not? You know, we're not responsible for the consequences of our writing. We're just putting it out there. It's clearly a story of public interest. I think the harder test is if you're in a situation where your work would have a negative impact relative to your self-interest. You know, how do you handle that type of situation? I'll tell you a real-life example of this. Is the question that during presidential campaigns, investigative reporters find themselves assigned by their newsroom to go hammer at candidate X or candidate Y. Those assignments are not made on the basis of political orientation. Someone's got to hammer at candidate X, you know. And there's a real issue for a lot of journalists of, you know, feeling like, you know, hell, maybe you vote once. You know, that doesn't have any impact, but if you go out there and find real destructive, material about a particular candidate, you know, the one you were planning to vote for, the one you hope gets elected, you know, doesn't it kind of become the case that your primary role in the body public is destructive? That irrespective of your engagement with the normal tasks of being a citizen, voting, carrying signs, donating, which these are things we don't do, but even if you did them, that would be so much less consequential than the weight of your testimony on the subject of that candidate's performance and character. Now, speaking of the topic this morning, I'll tell you.